This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
This fine podcast is a proud member of the Rabble Podcast Network, which is a hand-picked collection of Canadian podcasts on Rabble.ca that offer an alternative take on politics, society, community, and life in general. Rabble.ca is a non-profit, community-funded media site, and they need your support to keep going. Please help out at rabble.ca/donate. Your support helps podcasts like this get out to the world.
And you're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO, at 100.5 FM.
Corporate Europe Observatory, or CEO, is a research and campaign group working to expose and challenge the privileged access enjoyed by corporations and their lobby groups in European Union policymaking. Last November, they released a report titled Profiting from Injustice. It is an examination of how law firms, arbitrators, and financiers are fueling an investment arbitration boom. Pia Eberhardt is a researcher at CEO and co-author of the report. She joins us now by phone from Cologne, Germany. Good morning, Pia.
Hi, good evening from my side.
Wow, yes. What was the driving force behind initiating this study?
Well, I did a research on how companies and industry groups were trying to influence the future EU investment policy with countries such as Canada 2 years ago. And during that research, I came across a number of law firms who had lobbied the EU institutions. And I found that quite unique. Usually, they are not that active players in influencing EU trade policy. So this made me wonder, what is their role actually in this legal field? And I started talking to other campaigners, mainly from the Global South, who work on investment treaties and arbitration. And I had the impression that people felt lawyers were important, but no one actually knew who they were and what their role was. And so this was the starting point for looking more closely into the role of lawyers.
And what were some of your key findings?
Well, I guess the key finding is that lawyers are not just the neutral experts or intermediaries as whom they portray themselves in the field. It's quite the contrary. They make a lot of money from when companies sue states on the basis of investment treaties. Investment lawyers at the big law firms running the show in this field can earn up to $1,000 per hour. And usually you have a group of lawyers on a case, and the cases run for ages, so we can already see that this is really big business for the big law firms. The arbitrators, who are also lawyers deciding the cases, usually you have three of them sitting on a panel, they also earn quite hefty fees per hour. So the legal industry profits a lot from this legal field, and has a vested interest in promoting it. And this is what lawyers actually have done. You can see that it's really lawyers who advertise the legal field in the corporate world. They run around telling their multinational clients that this system exists and that they could use it to sue countries whenever they're not happy with a regulation or political change. So you could really argue that probably we wouldn't have that many lawsuits against countries from foreign investors if it wasn't for the law firms advertising the possibility.
And to follow up on that, what are some of the recent disputes that you highlight in the report that kind of point to that discrepancy?
Well, I mean, you have a number of disputes that are ongoing at the moment that are really scandalous. Quite well known is Philip Morris lawsuits against Australia and Uruguay. And Philip Morris is suing both countries because they introduced very strict anti-smoking legislation requiring large health warnings on cigarette packs. And Philip Morris is arguing that this prevents the firm from displaying its trademark causing a loss of market share. Another really outrageous lawsuit is that of energy company Vattenfall. Vattenfall is currently suing Germany, wanting 3.7 billion euros in compensation because Germany decided to get out of nuclear power following the Fukushima disaster. There's also a number of ongoing cases against Canada. Two relatively recent ones challenge environmental policies. One is of a company that is not happy with the fact that Quebec got out of fracking, you know, this very contested gas extraction method. And Quebec actually said, well, we would like to place or put a moratorium on fracking to be able to conduct an environmental impact assessment. And now it is sued by a company called Lone Pine for this policy measure. And I think Lone Pine would like to get a quarter billion taxpayer dollars in compensation. So these are just three examples that highlight actually the power of these lawsuits and the treaties on which they are based, because they are really granting companies far-reaching rights to challenge all kind of democratic policies to protect public health, the environment, workers' rights, outside of national courts, and get a lot of money in case they win.
And when you say treaties, these are things like NAFTA or free trade agreements?
Yeah, exactly. It's free trade agreements such as NAFTA that have an investment protection chapter, but it's also the thousands of pure investment treaties, so they are a bit limited in scope than a full free trade agreement, and do just deal with foreign investments. And that's there's really thousands of these treaties in place that grant companies these rights to sue governments.
How many law firms would you say there are around the world who have this kind of a key role in determining these acts of arbitration?
Well, more and more law firms are actually getting into the field because it's so profitable. But I think you can say you have around maybe 20 to 40 big firms that run, that you can see in a large majority of cases, so representing the investors but also the states. Most of these firms, so really the big fish in the field, come from the U.S., but you also have a number of firms from the UK and France and also Canada. And the top three, that's Freshfields from the UK, White & Case from the US, and King & Spalding from the US. So big international law firms that are also active in other fields but have discovered this legal field really as a gold mine. And besides the firms, you have the arbitrators, whom I already mentioned, so that's the lawyers who actually decide the cases and then have an enormous power in weighing private against public interest. And in our report, we found that it's actually a relatively small number of lawyers that appear again and again in these investment arbitration panels. So we found that around a really small circle of 15 of them have decided more than half of all investor state disputes we know of. Some even call them the inner mafia, because it's apparently such a closed circle, people who know each other very well. Nearly all of them are older men, you can say, white, from the US, Western Europe, Canada. But it's really them who decide cases that impact people around the world. And until today, most of the cases have been filed against developing countries. So then you have these Western lawyers deciding whether the measure that Uruguay, for example, put in place to protect its people from smoking was correct.
And how would a lawyer or arbitrator launch a suit against a government?
Well, it's the company that launches a suit, so it's not normally it's not law firms suing, but so in the case that I mentioned, it's the company Lone Pine that is suing Canada. Lone Pine as the other companies are usually not working with in-house lawyers, but are represented by the big law firms. And countries that can afford it then also hire the service of these big law firms. It's only poorer countries that try to defend themselves with their own lawyers and very often are struggling with lack of resources and knowledge in the field. But it's even if it's companies suing that officially launch the case, as I said, it's really the law firms that have the global overview, you know, of this dense network of treaties, of the loopholes that they offer. And you can see them as quite active ambulance chasers, you know, like the lawyers in the 19th century that followed hospital ambulances into hospitals after an accident had happened, tried to recruit their clients in hospital. And this is actually what the big law firms do today. We came across a quite staggering example of the civil war in Libya. In the midst of that civil war, you know, while most of the world was watching TV and fearing massacres, these law firms had something completely different in mind. They published so-called client alerts for their multinational clients and saying, do you have a problem in Libya? Don't you worry, Libya has signed so many bilateral investment treaties. We know them all, and we know the opportunities that gives you to sue Libya for whatever loss you might have suffered, you know, in the civil war. So it's really this kind of advertisement that we argue has fueled the boom of investor-state lawsuits in the past two decades.
By definition, is this a conflict of interest, as arbitrators are supposed to be impartial?
We found quite many, and for that it's important to know that this whole argument, or an important argument for this legal system coming from states and multinational companies, is the need for a neutral court. So they claim, you know, when a foreign investor runs into problems with the host state, that investor cannot use national courts because they will be biased in favor of the host state. And what we now found is that this supposedly neutral alternative, namely investment arbitration, is really not very neutral at all, and that has to do a lot with the conflicts of interest on the side of arbitrators, because it's not like in normal courts you have sitting judges, they have a fixed salary that doesn't change no matter how many cases lawsuits are filed. That is different for the arbitrators who are paid per hour. So the more hours they work, the more they earn, the more cases are filed, the more often they are called to sit in a panel, the more they earn. And that in a system where you only have one party that can actually initiate a lawsuit, namely the investor, it's only the investor that can sue a state. This is an inherent incentive to come up with investor-friendly rulings or interpretations of treaties, because if the system is investor-friendly, that will mean that more investors will use it. You will have more cases in the future and just have more money in your pocket. So this is one example of a conflict of interest. Another is that you have a number of these very busy arbitrators that also work for law firms. So on the one hand, they sit as, let's say, they have the function of a judge. They decide a case. But they might make a decision that profits one of the clients of the law firms they also work for in another case. So another example of a conflict of interest that shows that the claimed neutrality of investment arbitration and impartiality is actually is a big myth.
You mentioned that only one side can initiate a claim, and that one side would be the investor's side. Why is that?
Well, that's how the treaties are structured. I mean, historically, the idea was to protect investors from the industrialized countries in the newly independent states in the post-colonial times against expropriation, so when the state took a factory away or the land. So that was their initial purpose. There was no thinking about, you know, should actually indigenous groups also have the right to use these treaties to sue an investor for human rights violations, for example. And there was also the idea was not to protect the state also against any misbehaving of the company. So the purpose from the beginning was a very one-sided legal instrument, and that has stayed until today. But what has changed is really that these treaties are now used to attack much more than just direct expropriations, but really simple democratic laws and decisions to protect the public interest. That is something like a mutation that has happened in the legal field, and that has a lot to do with the activities of the lawyers and the decisions they make. And the companies really using the legal field.
And in your study, you did an overview of this occurring across the world. Where does Canada stand in relation to this kind of investment arbitration elsewhere in the world?
Well, Canadian investors have sued other countries, but Canada has also been sued quite often, mainly on the basis of NAFTA. I think there's been over 30 lawsuits against Canada already on the basis of NAFTA. And despite this experience, Canada, strangely enough, is currently negotiating a number of new treaties. Most people in Canada will have heard of the Canada-China Investment Treaty that is about to be ratified and that people really have major concerns about. But Canada is also negotiating a broad free trade agreement with a very tough, very investor-friendly investment chapter with the EU. And if recent reports are true, then these negotiations are also about to be closed. And there is a draft of the investment chapter that was leaked in December that really is cause for a lot of concern and should worry Canadians, because it shows that despite the experience that Canada already has with these treaties and the power it grants multinationals in undermining and attacking democratic policy, Canada is apparently willing to again grant far-reaching rights to European investors, much more rights apparently than it has ever granted in a similar treaty.
Well, thank you very much for doing this research and for sharing your findings with us this evening from Cologne, Germany.
You're very welcome. Thanks to you.
I've been speaking with Pia Eberhardt, who's co-author with Cecilia Olivet of the report Profiting from Injustice, which was published in November 2012 by the Corporate Europe Observatory and the Transnational Institute. To read the full report, you can visit corporateeurope.org.